Hi, Sports Jam with Doug Doyle is celebrating 350 episodes since 2008 by airing some of the Hall of Fame editions of the show for you. My guest in July of 2012 was track legend, sports broadcaster, and jazz guitarist Marty Licori. Enjoy. This is Sports Jam. I'm Doug Doyle. Joining us tonight from his home in Gainesville, Florida, is one of the most recognizable names in track and field history, Hall of Fame distance runner Marty Licori. Born and raised in Cedar Grove, New Jersey, a tremendous career on the track and in the broadcasting booth, and for many years, an accomplished jazz guitarist. Marty, thanks for joining us on Sports Jam.
It's a pleasure, Doug.
Marty, the Summer Olympics in London are here, so let's start with the Olympics. How do you think the U.S. team will fare?
Well, in track and field specifically, we'll do pretty well. You know, we have a strong team. I was a distance runner, so I'm particularly concerned about the distance events. And although the events in the long distance racing has been dominated by the Africans for the last couple of Olympics, the United States is probably the best non-African distance running team, and on both the men's and women's sides, we have some pretty good runners that could medal in the distance races from 1,500 meters on up.
One thing great about sports, Marty, is we can always try to make comparisons in different eras. How would Marty Licori fare in distance running right now in the Olympic Games?
Well, I guess the standard answer to that from anybody from another generation is that they think they would be running faster with the training and the shoes and the tracks that they have today. So if you are able to compete in your generation, you feel you'd be able to compete well in the current generation. But one thing that maybe would make that harder is that since I retired, track and field has really gone professional. And what that has done is enabled a fairer playing field, and athletes from all countries, not just the advanced countries, able to compete on an equal basis. So there are a lot more runners from Africa and third world countries competing today than there were in my time. So just from that fact, it would make it a little bit harder to be number one in the world now than it was back in my day.
Marty Licori is one of only six men to have been ranked number one in the world in both the mile 1,500 meters and in the 5,000 meters. Has that ever sunk in?
I don't think many people realize it. I think there's only one other person that did that that's not from Africa, and that was back in the 1950s. But basically, I was probably running the wrong event for most of my career. I was known as a miler and ranked number one in the world in the mile twice, but I really should have been a longer distance runner. But it's kind of like if you're a miler, that's what everybody wants you to run. That's what the meet directors want you to race in, and I didn't move up until later in my career.
Your Olympic career ended with the boycott of 1980.
Yeah, I didn't have good luck with the Olympics, and I think most people don't realize how hard it is to win the Olympics because we have so many gold medal winners in America, but it is really very tough to be able to come up on the perfect performance one day in every 4 years. And in my case, I was injured for two of the three Olympics that were in my career, and the fourth one, as you said, was 1980, was the Olympic boycott. So the Olympic timing wasn't kind to me. But on the other side of the coin, those injuries were what enabled me to get into broadcasting, which for 25, 30 years was my occupation. I got to do the commentary on most of the Olympic Games, and that's been a great thing in my life.
In 1968, you finished second to Jim Ryan in the U.S. Olympic trials at the age of 19. Your battles with Jim Ryan are legendary, especially those who follow track and field. You still are the youngest 1,500-meter finalist, and you were at the Mexico City Olympics. Can you take us back to the time when you and Jim Ryan were competing? What do you remember best about that tremendous rivalry?
Well, I think what I remember is that America was focused on it. you know, it's 1968, the NBA was pretty big, but it wasn't as big as it was now. None of the pro sports, except maybe baseball, were that much bigger than track and field. And so it was a time when not only was track and field still important in the United States, but we had the two best milers in the world, and that doesn't always happen. And when something like that happens, it enables each of those runners to push each other farther than they would have been if they came along on their own.
And that certainly was the case in 1971 at Franklin Field in Philadelphia.
The mile everyone's been waiting for the last several weeks, Jim Ryan, Marty Lacoury. Adrenaline has really been going all week in the press, television. Lacoury there in the white, Ryan right next to him. And here we go. They're coming now at the half-mile mark.
And here we go. Ryan is taking the lead.
Lacoury moves right with him. And Lacoury moving out in front of Ryan.
Lacoury might be trying to take the starch out of Ryan at this point, trying to push that so Ryan doesn't have that tremendous last lap effort. Let's see if Lacoury can hold on to him. He's doing a pretty good job.
Trying to fight him off right now as they head down the straight. It's Lacoury. Ryan coming. Lacoury.
What a race.
1 yard. Lacoury has got away and is in a second.
Marty Lacoury. Pandemonium.
54-6 for that last quarter. 354-6 unofficial for this mile. As Marty Lacoury defeats Jim Ryan.
I was very fortunate that Jim Ryan came along just before I did, and I hope he thinks that he was fortunate that I came in, you know, towards the tail end of his career and kept it interesting.
What kind of relationship did you have with Jim Ryan?
Well, not much. You know, we were young guys, and you get to a track meet, and it was all business. It wasn't like it was today where guys will be on the tour for weeks at a time and get to know each other, hanging out in the hotel. So I would say we don't have as close a relationship as some of the guys who are playing in the game today.
As we wrap up this segment talking about the Olympics and your Olympic career, have they lost their luster, Marty?
Well, I don't know. I was involved and always at the Olympics. The last Olympics was the first time I stayed home and actually watched it and saw what some of the other events are like. And I guess this is a segue to the next segment, but in my life today, as a musician, hanging out with musicians and the general public, now it seems like the Olympics are not much of a bleep on the public's upcoming schedule.
Why is that, Marty?
Well, I think there's just so many things. You go from a great NBA championships, you got the NFL. There are so many great big events, Wimbledon, and then the Olympics becomes just another one of those big events where, as years ago, before, 1968, you're talking about before there was a Super Bowl, and the Olympics only happened every 4 years. So the Olympics were much more in the forefront, and as time goes by and there's more and more bigger events, I think it comes down in its status.
This is Sports Jam, and my guest tonight is the great runner Marty Lacoury, who not only excelled on the track but in the broadcasting booth and on the jazz stage now, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the program. I want to go back, though, Marty, to your days at Essex Catholic High School here in Newark. This radio station is based here in Newark. You were coached by Fred Dwyer, and during that time you had some amazing success, not only personally, but the team as well.
Well, that's one of the things that was different in those days. I went to Essex Catholic High School, and in the previous, let's say, 5 years before I graduated, every year a runner from that school was getting a scholarship to a Georgetown or a Holy Cross or a Penn State. So when I went into the situation and the coach told me and told my parents, hey, your son needs to stop playing the guitar and get serious about this running because he can get a scholarship, I believed him, and it was true. Well, today a lot of things have changed. So American kids don't have that same motivation. A college scholarship for running, especially distance running, would be a very rare thing for an American kid today. So, I met Fred Dwyer at Essex Catholic. He was a very qualified individual. It was a very fortunate thing for me.
And you actually had another member of the 1968 Olympic team, I believe. Mark Muro was the javelin thrower?
Right. He was a national record in high school javelin and a great javelin thrower. So, yeah, two guys who made the Olympic team in high school from one high school, whereas today there probably aren't two colleges or a college that maybe has two athletes on the Olympic team, because with professionalism now, there are less and less college, and certainly I can't even think of any high school athletes who would, you know, make the Olympic team.
You grew up in Cedar Grove, and of course we just mentioned Essex Catholic High School. You graduated, but you actually started running for another sport. You were trying to get in shape for basketball.
I had no idea what track and field or cross-country running was about. I went to Essex Catholic High School, and I can remember somebody just turning around telling me, well, if you're going out for basketball, you should go out for this cross-country stuff because the coach likes you to be in shape for basketball season, and that's really why I went out for it. And it was the first time I was in an individual sport. I had played baseball and basketball and been frustrated being on team sports. And I got into this individual sport, and I really liked it, and I was pretty good at it, and I stuck with it.
You know, you're the kind of guy that those of us who were in high school in gym class, we didn't like you kind of guys, especially knowing that you could run the mile in less than 4 minutes.
Well, yeah, it's like a lot of things. You know, 4 minutes seems very hard, but when you say, well, you know, here's what you do every day for 10 years, and eventually you'll do it. I mean, I come to music now, and, you know, when I wasn't a guitar player, and you look at a Wes Montgomery, Joe Pass, any of those guys, what they're doing just seems impossible. But then when you get into it and realize, well, it's going to take years and years and years of studying, and here's how you build on it. I guess what I learned from running that helped me in music was that nothing is really impossible. It might be really hard, but nothing is impossible.
What a great race this should be. Kip Keno, the Olympic champion at this distance, against Marty Lacouri, who was ranked number one in the world in 1969 for 1,500 meters. Keno, who in Mexico City ran 334.9 to win his gold medal. Now, Keno coming in for the gun lap. And he gets the gun. And his time with a lap to go, 2 minutes, 39 seconds. And Lacouri, who was a tremendous finisher, and he looks like he still has something here with Chris Mason in third. And now it's Keno in the middle turn, and here comes Lacouri. Lacouri making his move. Keno is obviously tired. He's very tired, and Lacouri coming up behind him. Now he's just 3 yards behind. Keno moving out to the side, and Lacouri going by him. 20 meters to go to the finish. Marty Lacouri winning this race.
What goes into a distance runner? Boy, it just must be grueling.
Well, it's kind of grueling, but I think distance runners are a lot like musicians in a lot of ways. We're usually self-directed. We're usually concerned about pleasing ourselves and not other people. We are able to spend hours of time on our own, and, you know, there's research now coming out more and more about, you know, we're not shy. We just like to be alone, and you work hard by yourself, and then you go to either a gig or you go to a race and you work with other people in the team or the band. And so there's a lot of similarities, and I think that the lessons, I happened to be an athlete first. I happened to be in a sport that was very scientific, and you had to be self-directed. But that helped me with music. Now, I would also say if a kid takes up music and maybe, you know, takes piano lessons from the time they're 6 till they're 15, even if they never perform or become a musician, that the things that they've learned in becoming good at music and thinking like a musician are going to help them in whatever they do in life.
What has been more difficult for you, to play the jazz guitar well, or when you were back in the days or running competitively in the Olympics, the Olympic trials? What has been more difficult for you?
Well, I would say getting it's two different things, because in running, you can say, okay, so-and-so was number one in the world this year because he ran the fastest and he beat everybody. But you can never say who's the best guitar player, even if you wanted to say who's the best straight-ahead guitar player. You can never measure the things like that. But music is harder in the fact that it becomes your mistress, just a tremendous time suck. With running and sports, you really can't work at it more than 2 hours, 3 hours a day because of the physicality of it. But with music, you can. And I remember hearing that, you know, Pat Metheny practiced for 12 hours a day, and I thought, no, that's crazy. But then when you get into it and you realize music is tougher because there's so much more to learn. You're going to be 80 years old, and you're still going to be learning at a tremendously fast rate. So it's tougher to really, you know, get to the top in music.
This is the acoustic jazz duo, Marty LaCorey and Friends, performing at Leonardo 7 and 6 in Gainesville, Florida.
How exciting and how fun has it been for you? You wanted to be a guitar player when you were a kid, and now you get to not only experience an amazing career on the track, in the broadcasting booth, and now you get to do your real passion, jazz.
Yeah, it's been a real gift, and one of the great things in my life. It's a lot like running and athletics in so many ways, without the pain and the blisters. And it has just been great. I've been very fortunate in that I live down here in Florida. There are a lot of retired great musicians around here, and if you find them and get them to play with you, they're great mentors. So we have a very great jazz scene here in Gainesville, Florida. It's a big university town, and it's been great.
Your first electric guitar. I have been told that you didn't want to pay an extra $20 for a Fender Strat, so you got a Gibson SG. Is that true?
Yeah, that was probably one of the bigger mistakes in my life. I got a Les Paul Jr. for $100, but if I'd had $150, it probably would have been a Strat, which would today be a real collectible.
Our good friend Vince Cartier passing that little nugget along to us. Now, you talk about how a jazz tradition started for you. At Leonardo's on Mondays and Thursday nights, it's become a tradition in Gainesville, and you've been influenced by Bucky Pizzarelli. Tell us about some of the people who have influenced your career.
Well, I was very fortunate to meet Bucky, and he came down here and did some concerts. And I was one of the reasons I took up music wasn't with the idea of becoming a professional musician. I just had a curiosity about why Bucky Pizzarelli sounded like he did, why Wes Montgomery sounded like he did, why Joe Pass or Jim Hall, why they all sounded so differently. And that curiosity got me into it. And I was fortunate to meet Bucky and actually drive him around the state when he had some gigs and you know, learn some things. Like one story I tell that you can't learn in books. You're not going to learn it on YouTube. One time, Bucky plays a certain type of rhythmic chords, and to get that sound, he uses very heavy strings on a very big guitar. And I said to him, well, Bucky, if I use those big strings three times a week playing 3 hours a night, my hands are killing me. And he said, oh, yeah, one of the things was that we had two guitars. We had one with those heavy strings for playing rhythm, and then we had another one that was strung up with lighter strings for when we had to play our solos. And I've mentioned that to some guitar players who, you know, are at the top of the game, and they go, oh, I always wondered why you'd see pictures of those old guys and they have two guitars on the stage. So sometimes things are only going to be passed down orally. They're just not in books. You're not going to find them anywhere. And I was fortunate to get some of that kind of stuff from Bucky.
Now, that's just a part of your style. You also, how about the Hot Club DeVille and Django Reinhardt?
Well, I was fortunate in that a great gypsy jazz guitar player came through town here about 15 years ago. And when I heard it, I didn't realize that for 15 years I had been listening to Django Reinhardt because I collected the records listening to the violinist Stefan Grappelli. And when I heard some gypsy jazz live for the first time, I said, oh my goodness, I've been listening to that for years. And I was automatically able to play that music better than, say, the straight-ahead jazz that I was trying to play, because the language that of that genre was already in my head. I've been playing it now for about 10, 15 years, and of course the Woody Allen movie, Midnight in Paris, and some other things have given it a real kick up, and it's very popular. We play that on Monday nights, and then on Thursday nights we play the straight-ahead jazz, you know, with drums and upright bass and all that kind of stuff. So it keeps it interesting for me, but, you know, Django is just such a major influence for all guitar players, and he has been for me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Sports Jam, and my guest is Marty LaQuarrie. Yes, jazz musician Marty LaQuarrie, as well as one of the most recognizable names in track and field history, a tremendous miler, and then in the broadcast booth. Marty, when you think about, I ask this of my guests sometimes, you could be Django Reinhardt kind of player and have that fame, or Bucky Pizzarelli, or all the accomplishments you've done in track and field. Would you trade it in?
If I had had a career as a musician, I think all these things, the running or being a musician, that one of the values of that is, do you get to travel around and see the world? And so what I would tell a young person today is, because some people think music is a very tough business, it's hard to make a living at it now, but if you can do something that enables you to see the world, that's what's interesting to me. I'm so happy that I saw the world, and I know that people do it through music. I know some people do it through sports, but that to me is has been one of my goals in life, and I've been able to achieve it.
There was a time in Marty LaQuarrie's life that may have been in jeopardy. You're a cancer survivor. You were diagnosed with leukemia in the early 90s, but fortunately in remission since 95.
Well, I can say that I would not be a musician if that hadn't happened. I got my wake-up call. I had leukemia. I was able to take some chemotherapy and knock it back. But when that happened, I evaluated my life and everything I was doing and said, if I have remaining time, what would I like to do? And one of the things I always wanted to do was be a jazz guitarist. And so I pursued that, and it kind of, you know, grew on its own and, you know, became a full-time occupation, which I really hadn't planned on. But it took the cancer, and, you know, a lot of times people get a cancer diagnosis, and maybe some of us who are on the other side of it sort of know that someday you may just say that was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And so in many ways in my life, it was, because I prioritized my life. I made a pretty big change and decided I didn't want to be sitting on airplanes flying all over to track meets for the rest of my life. And, you know, I don't think I'd be in music if it hadn't been for that happening.
When you moved to Gainesville in 1972 to train and actually go to school at the University of Florida, you started Athletic Addicts, a running shoe franchise. That was before they even had big shoe stores for athletes and these shoe stores. What gave you the idea to do that?
Well, we were the first store to sell just athletic shoes. We came back from the Munich Olympics in 1972, and we saw people over there wearing athletic shoes all the time, wearing jogging suits all the time, and this was just as the running boom would start to take off in America. And we went to malls and stuff, so we want to open a store. We're just going to sell athletic footwear. They said, well, you can't do that. You need baseball bats and fishing poles. You have to have all the sporting apparatus. And, you know, we did it. We were just a shoe store. And now, as you know, if you go into a mall, there's going to be seven places that just sell athletic shoes.
You mentioned the games in Munich. What was that like?
Well, you know, I was a broadcaster there, and people at home in America probably know more about what that was like than I did, because, you know, you had the massacre. but I'm in a hotel in Germany trying to watch it on German television. I didn't know what was going on, and it wasn't until many years later that I came back and was able to see on YouTube and on the Internet the commentary that my colleague Jim McKay did.
They've now said that there were 11 hostages. Two were killed in their rooms yesterday morning. 9 were killed at the airport tonight. They're all gone.
How was it working with Jim McKay, one of the legends of the broadcasting industry and broadcasting booth? What did you learn from him?
Well, Jim McKay was, you know, the definition of a nice guy, laid-back guy. And one of the things I learned from him was that you don't become the story. The story is the athletes on the field. You could leave the Olympics or any big event with Jim McKay and kind of walk down the street, and nobody really recognized him or remembered him. Contrast to working with Howard Cosell, who I also worked with not as frequently, who made himself bigger than the event. So I kind of made a decision there. The other little trick that you'd appreciate being in the business was at the end of an event, when somebody was crossing the finish line or the end of a marathon, Jim had really scripted his ad libs. He had written out a one-page summary for maybe the top 10 guys who were going to maybe win the Olympic marathon. So what seemed like was stream of conscious was really he was always well-prepared, and he did his homework beforehand.
What hasn't Marty Lequeri done? You had your B.A. from Villanova, where you're a great track star, master's degree in broadcasting from the University of Florida, now an accomplished jazz musician, and a member of the U.S. Track and Field Hall of Fame, the Penn Relays and Wall of Fame, the Italian-American Hall of Fame, the Villanova Hall of Fame, the New Jersey Hall of Fame. Is there anything Marty Lequeri can't do, and what of those honors are you most proud of?
Well, I would change the question. There's nothing that anybody can't do if they set their mind to it and, you know, are willing to spend the time. Now, I will say about the jazz guitar thing, if a teacher had pulled me aside and told me how hard it was going to be, I might have stopped. I guess I thought, you know, 2 or 3 years of woodshedding and you'll be ready to go. I didn't realize how many hours it was going to take and how much music theory, and I've been fortunate to be able to play twice a week. People who don't get to gig twice a week, even if they go to music school, they have a much, you know, harder time. So I guess the question is, we can all do whatever we set our minds to if we are fortunate enough to have the right people pointing the way for us. I have a guy down here, his name is Ben Champion, sax player, played with Dizzy, was a contemporary of his. And there's so many little things I learned from him on the bandstand that have enabled me to progress much faster than if I didn't have a mentor like that.
Who would you like to play with?
Dead or alive?
Yeah, we can go dead or alive.
Yeah, well, of course, just to be in the presence of Django or Thelonious Monk would just be a dream for me. Sonny Rollins, I got to thank Sonny for being here in 1972 in Gainesville and giving a concert. And I saw that. And I always tell people, if people say they don't like jazz, now of course jazz is just such a big thing, but I always think if you just tell people to get Sonny Rollins playing Don't Stop the Carnival, if you listen to that song, at the end of it, you cannot say you don't like jazz. So I thank Sonny for getting me interested in jazz in about 1972.
You also have had a great partner in your life. At the age of 47, she did something special for you for Christmas. What was it?
Well, she's probably regretting giving me the guitar lessons that kind of got this all started. Yes, my wife, Deborah, gave me some guitar lessons, and that started it all off. And she encouraged me in the music because she realized pretty quickly that this is part of what I am and what I need.
Well, Marty, you have good taste, and obviously throughout your career you had great feet. and you did great feats on the track and field, and now are doing it in the music field as a jazz guitarist. Marty LaCoury, thanks so much for joining us on Sports Jam.
Thanks, Doug. It was a lot of fun.
Sports Jam is a WBGO News production celebrating more than 350 episodes since 2008. You can check out all the shows by going to WBGO.org/Sports Jam or find Sports Jam with Doug Doyle on iTunes and on the NPR list of podcasts. Until our next Sports Jam session, I'll see you at the game.